Good morning, and welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center here at the Kaiser Family Foundation. I am Tricia Newman, a Senior Vice President at the Foundation, and I am the Executive Director of our Program on Medicare Policy. We are here today to talk about Medicare, just in case you want to be sure you're in the right room, the people who are covered by Medicare, and Medicare's role in deficit and debt reduction discussions. We are really pleased this morning to have Bruce Vladek and Gail Walensky, who will be with us in a little while, to offer their perspectives on the Medicare debate as it's currently being framed, and we'll get back to them in a little while. It's almost hard to believe that just a little bit more than a year ago, there was a great deal of debate about the Medicare savings and the health reform law, as you may remember. But here we are, a year later, and once again, we are talking about Medicare savings, but this time in the context of deficit and debt reduction. Medicare savings are back on the table, as you can see here, because Medicare is growing as a share of the economy. That's on the left side as a share of GDP. And also, Medicare accounts for a relatively large share of the federal budget, and it's growing as a share of the federal budget. So as you can see now, Medicare is at about 15% of the federal budget. And when conversations start to focus on reducing federal spending and reducing the federal budget, they invariably turn back to Medicare. As the administration and Congress edge closer to a vote on raising the debt limit, and as policymakers continue to discuss policy options to reduce spending, it's not entirely clear to me, to us, what specific proposals they're talking about or what might be on the table. It's not entirely clear what the magnitude of savings are likely to be. But what is clear, as you can see in this exhibit, is that virtually every proposal that has focused on deficit and debt reduction have talked about Medicare savings in some form and of some magnitude. This is a sort of a cheat sheet, if you will, but it shows you the nature of different types of proposals that are under discussion, some broad, some narrow. But what you can see is a couple of things. One is several options are on the table, and two, there's a good bit of disagreement about which option should be given serious consideration. While there is some potential for agreement on the general concept of Medicare savings as part of debt reduction, it's quite clear that it's going to be a bit of a heavy lift to come to agreement and to determine which of the proposals are under discussion. And that's for a couple of reasons. First, Medicare is very popular among seniors who vote. I think that's no surprise to everyone in this room. Medicare provides coverage to people without regard to their income, without regard to their medical history, and that's pretty important to people on Medicare who tend to get sicker as they get older. And so medical insurance that's guaranteed to them without regard to their health conditions really matter. I think many of you in the room know that about half of all people on half of all seniors lacked health insurance before Medicare was enacted. So today we almost take it for granted that we can get health, seniors can get health insurance when they turn 65. But this thing about taking Medicare for granted shakes a little bit loose when seniors are confronted with the very real prospect of losing this coverage. So that's the first reason why, you know, I think coming to consensus on significant Medicare savings may be difficult. The second reason is that even with the benefits that people get from Medicare today, many people on Medicare have considerable skin in the game. Now, we have been looking at out-of-pocket spending as a share of income for quite some time. And what we have documented, and you can see this in the materials in your folder, is that over the years, the share of out-of-pocket, the share of income devoted to healthcare spending has continued to tick up. And it's pretty straightforward. It's because healthcare spending is rising more rapidly than income. The concern here is that some people on Medicare really do pay a great deal. And as you can see in this exhibit, many beneficiaries are spending a large share of their income. In fact, one in four people on Medicare spend 30% or more of their incomes on health care in 2006. So asking people on Medicare to pay more is going to be a concern, at least for some who are already paying a great deal. And as you can see in this exhibit, people on Medicare have a greater health care burden than non-Medicare households. This is in terms of absolute dollars and as a share of their household budgets. Healthcare accounts for 15% of household budgets for people on Medicare versus 5% for non-Medicare households. So what you know, when you hear that people on Medicare aren't paying enough or don't have a health care burden, I think the facts may tell a different story. A third reason why the search for savings could be quite a challenge is because of the significant savings that were recently enacted in the health reform bill. Turning back to where I started a few minutes ago, there were significant savings, a net of a little bit more than $400 billion in savings over a 10-year period. And as a result of these provisions, which you can see here, and if you focus on the orange bars for a second, Medicare spending, if you look at the period between 2010 and 2019, on a per capita basis, is projected to grow quite slowly relative to the economy, even when you adjust for physician fees, which we use the shorthand of SGR. And if you compare Medicare per capita spending to what it was in previous years, the group of bars on the left side, you can see that due to the health reform law in large part, Medicare will grow far more slowly in the next several years than it has in the past on a per capita basis. The fact that Medicare has such low projected per capita spending growth means that it will be that much harder for negotiators to find what some are calling the low-hanging fruit. So in a few minutes, we will turn to Bruce Vladeck and Gail Walensky to offer their perspectives on this low-hanging fruit and whether what policy options are likely to be considered. But before we get to that, it would not be a Kaiser event if we didn't have a few more wonky slides and if we didn't focus on the people who are deeply affected by the prospects of this debate. So we are going to begin this morning with Dr. Gretchen Jacobson, who is a principal policy analyst here at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's going to be presenting results from a study that she did in conjunction with Karen Smith, who's here from the Urban Institute, that looked at two questions that are quite important, we think, when we start to talk about policies that would shift costs onto people on Medicare. First, how affluent are people on Medicare today? What do we know about their income and their savings? And second, will Medicare beneficiaries in the future, will the next generation of people on Medicare have significantly greater capacity to absorb rising costs? So with that, I'm going to turn it to Gretchen to help answer those questions.
Good morning. So today I'll present a brief overview of some of the work that we have done that examines the income and assets of current and future Medicare beneficiaries. This work was done in conjunction with Karen Smith at the Urban Institute and is summarized in a spotlight in your folder. The data I will present is from a microsimulation model of people's financial experience over their lifetimes. Our questions were, how much money do people on Medicare currently have, and what is the outlook for the next generation of Medicare beneficiaries, those who are currently in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s? Most people on Medicare have less than $22,000 in income in 2010, as you can see here by the red bar on the left. There is wide variation in the incomes across subgroups of people on Medicare. You can see here in the yellow bars that most white beneficiaries have higher incomes than most black and Hispanic beneficiaries. Also, the disabled people on Medicare who are younger than 65 and the people who are 85 or older also tend to have lower incomes, as shown in the green bars. Most of the people ages 65 to 74, the wealthiest age group, had incomes below $27,000 in 2010. You can also see that single and widowed Medicare beneficiaries had much lower incomes than Medicare beneficiaries who are married. Most of them had incomes below $26,000 per year per individual. So, as Tricia said, this research really gets at the core question: how affluent are the elderly? So we began by examining the distribution of income among people on Medicare and found it to be very skewed. As you saw earlier, half of all people on Medicare had incomes below $22,000 in 2010. And 25% had less than $13,000 in income. However, when we look at the other end of the distribution, we find that 5% had more than $87,000 in income. And 1 in 100 had more than $150,000 in income in 2010. So we then looked at how much do people have to draw upon in savings, either in a retirement account, such as an IRA, or other financial assets, such as savings, stocks, or bonds. In other words, how much do they have in their retirement nest eggs? The vast majority of people on Medicare had about 91% of them had some savings. However, just as we saw with income, the distribution of savings among beneficiaries is skewed. Half of all people on Medicare had less than $53,000 in savings in 2010, which is less than the cost of 1 year in a nursing home. And 25% of people on Medicare had less than $8,400 in savings. However, on the other end of the distribution, 10% had more than $570,000 in savings. And 5% of people had more than $1 million in savings. So lastly, we looked at the extent to which people on Medicare could draw upon the equity in their homes to cover their other expenses. Nearly one quarter of people on Medicare did not have equity in their homes in 2010. Like we saw with income and savings, the distribution of home equity among people on Medicare is also very skewed. Half of all people on Medicare had less than $61,000 in equity in their homes in 2010. And as you see here, nearly one quarter of people on Medicare did not have any home equity to draw upon. However, on the other end of the distribution, 10% had more than $250,000 in home equity. And 5% had more than $350,000 in home equity in 2010. So, given the current policy discussions that would affect future Medicare beneficiaries, we wanted to know whether the next generation of Medicare beneficiaries who are currently in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s will be wealthier than current Medicare beneficiaries. We found that incomes will be slightly higher among the next generation of Medicare beneficiaries, and these numbers are adjusted for inflation. Half of all people on Medicare will have less than $27,000 in 2030, up from $22,000 in 2010. Yet, when we look at the change in income stratified by percentiles, we can see that there's more growth in the upper income groups than among the lower income groups. Income is also projected to grow more among whites than blacks and Hispanics, and projected to grow more among the higher educated subgroups. We saw similar patterns in the growth of savings and home equity with somewhat greater savings in home equity in 2030 than in 2010. Yet much of this growth in assets is projected to be concentrated among a minority of Medicare beneficiaries, leading to a wider gap in assets among the next generation of Medicare beneficiaries. So, in summary, most people on Medicare have modest means with limited incomes, limited savings, and limited home equity. There are some people on Medicare with higher incomes and assets, but they account for a relatively small share of the population. Looking to the future, incomes and assets are projected to be somewhat greater, but the growth is projected to be concentrated among a small subset of the population, who are disproportionately white and college-educated beneficiaries. This analysis helps to paint a picture of the financial well-being of Medicare beneficiaries and how the next generation will fare as policymakers look for ways to slow the growth in Medicare spending and help to lower the national debt and reduce federal spending. Thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen. Now to help us understand what these numbers really mean for people, I'm going to turn it over to Juliet Kubanski, who is Associate Director of the Program on Medicare Policy and co-author of a report that's in your folder. And Juliet, if you could come up.
Good morning. As Tricia said, this wouldn't be a true Kaiser event on Medicare if, in the midst of our lovely slides and data, we didn't take some time to focus a bit on the people who benefit from the valuable financial and health protections provided by the Medicare program. So earlier this year, Kaiser embarked on a project to interview 16 Medicare beneficiary families in and around three metropolitan areas across the country, here in Washington, D.C., in Detroit, Michigan, and in the Los Angeles area. We wanted to learn about the financial challenges facing these beneficiaries in managing their household spending on relatively limited incomes, as well as the extent to which they faced burdensome health care costs. We interviewed both married couples and single individuals, or in some cases their caregivers, people with an array of health conditions, incomes, and financial circumstances. None are very wealthy, and none are impoverished, but some only get by with help from family members, or they rely on credit cards, and few have significant savings or retirement accounts to draw upon. Most of those we interviewed do not qualify for any extra help for the government in paying for their health care costs or their other basic needs. The project had two outcomes. The first is a report called Living on the Edge, which is included in your packets, which provides detailed profiles of the 16 beneficiaries we interviewed. The second is a video produced by Kaiser's own Jackie Judd that you are about to see for its premiere showing here this morning. Jackie spent time with three of the families from our interview project and has woven their stories together into one compelling piece. As the report documents, but as Jackie's video really brings to life, these are people on Medicare who are, for the most part, just getting by and worried about making ends meet for the rest of their lives, and who could be greatly affected by the outcome of the federal deficit reduction debate that we're here to hear more about this morning. So with that, I am extremely pleased to introduce Making Ends Meet, the Medicare Generation.
Family budgets are being strained in all kinds of ways these days. Higher gas prices, higher food bills, higher health care costs. Older Americans on fixed incomes feel the pinch more than most. The golden years are certainly not shaping up the way 66-year-old Priscilla Greer of suburban Maryland had expected.
All I say, old age is full of surprises.
The surprise is the day-in, day-out struggle to make ends meet, compounded by her and her husband's chronic and complex health problems. Priscilla has been treated for cancer and is diabetic. Her husband, Marvin, hospitalized when we met, is diabetic, has early Alzheimer's, gastrointestinal problems, and several strokes have left him with limited mobility. Both have Medicare and supplemental insurance to help with medical expenses.
To begin with, the money that we're spending for the insurance, $631 a month, that is ridiculous. American Express. That's a heart attack.
But those premiums they pay for their supplemental coverage are only the half of it. Co-pays and cost-sharing bring their monthly health bills to over $1,100. Add to that all the other stuff of daily life.
We live on American Express. Unfortunately, I try not to. But usually a lot of times I have to use American Express for gasoline and groceries and prescriptions.
And there is also now a MasterCard. It is, says Priscilla, the first time she has accumulated credit card debt. The Greers are, by the government standards, middle income, but it doesn't feel like a middle class life. Priscilla volunteers at a food bank so she can bring home some free groceries. Friends occasionally give her small sums of money. She consolidates errands to conserve gasoline.
Yeah, well, it gets you. It gets to you.
What are the worst moments?
When it's time to pay the bills, that's hard. You take and pay the ones that are most urgent, that you know that they will cut you off if you don't.
Priscilla wonders whether she and her husband could have made different financial decisions in earlier years so they had more of a cushion now. But given the Greers' modest incomes, it's unlikely they could have saved enough to get them through the unexpected costs of old age.
Mama, let's pray about this cold because we don't want...
80-year-old Georgia Williamson, who lives in a senior apartment complex near Detroit, is a widow and the matriarch of a large family.
You can handle that.
Her daughter, Rita Williams, is a near constant presence and fierce advocate when it comes to managing her mother's scant finances.
She usually has maybe, at the end of the month, maybe $100, $150 left. I try to establish a relationship with all her doctors, not just say, well, I'm just going to pay you a little bit and not worry about it, because I never know which doctor she's going to need in the future.
Georgia has a couple of thousand in savings in addition to her monthly income, so this is a precarious hold on solvency. Monthly rent is just under half her income. The next biggest chunk is health care.
The financial burden created for my mother as far as her health care bills, sometimes it places a lot on her because she wonders, you know, how am I going to get this bill paid, or is this doctor not going to see me because I didn't pay the full amount, and here I am going back to the doctor again. And we try to tell her, no, you know, and if they're not going to see you because you didn't pay, well, I'll kick in and pay. You ain't supposed to have no saw.
Georgia has Medicare, and her late husband's employer pays the premiums for supplemental retiree coverage. She takes six or seven medications and has an equal number of specialty doctors. On hold, though, is a visit to the dentist, whose bills are not covered by insurance or Medicare.
One of the upcoming expenses is dental, trying to get dentures made, because that's a big out-of-pocket cost as opposed to getting your real teeth fixed and things like that. So that's something we have to work with the dentist and find one that's willing to work with us as far as making monthly payments until the bill is paid.
New dentures would probably wipe out that small end-of-month surplus, which is only possible as it is because of the day-to-day support Georgia gets from her family.
I don't think my mother would be able to meet her expenses, probably, and probably not even live here, because she would need somebody else to probably help her with her meals, somebody to do all the shopping for her, the washing, things like that. So she would really have to truly downsize from where she has already downsized.
How you doing today?
Rita Williams worries about the time when her mother's needs may become greater and more complex, and whether the safety net the family surrounds her with can be maintained.
nice to have the time off, but...
Darlene and Robert Hirsch of Southern California got a financial jolt when Robert lost his $100,000-a-year job as a pharmacist.
Watch yourself. November 30th, he said goodbye. December 1st, I'm out of a job. No severance pay.
Robert hasn't found work since and worries that at 69, his income-producing days are over. After losing his employer-sponsored insurance, he moved to COBRA and will soon transfer to Medicare. He has severe allergies. Darlene, a retired manicurist, has more serious issues, including chronic fatigue. And a few years ago, she had a benign brain tumor removed. Darlene is on Medicare, the Part D drug plan, and has supplemental and dental insurance. Together, they live on Social Security and Robert's unemployment, which will end later this year. Once it does, more money will be going out than coming in.
Right now on expenses, we're trying to hold our own. We're bailing out and keeping the water at an even level.
The Hirsches are not drowning because they're dipping into savings. Soon they will probably begin raiding their $40,000 retirement fund. And they're not even spending what they should on medical care. Dental work is on hold. Robert ignored a broken toe. Darlene has delayed a brain scan. Even though Medicare would cover that, she's afraid to find out what her portion of the cost would be.
I should be having an MRI. I should have had it already 6 months ago, and I've put that off. I'm saying to myself, I'm going to hope everything is okay. But, you know, and then another part of me is going, well, what if it's not?
Darlene is one of millions of people on Medicare to hit the donut hole. So for several months this year, she will pay much more for her prescription drugs.
Well, I know the medication that I take is about $1,000 a month when it's not covered. And I do have the donut hole, which I will have this year for probably 4 months.
The economics of life after 65 are daunting. To manage, the Hirsches have cut back, canceling trips to visit their children and social outings with friends.
I'm trying to find some kind of place where I can feel good and, you know, try to keep that fear of not having money and not being able to take care of ourselves. I'm trying to push that away.
Take your time.
There is nothing unusual about any of these stories. These beneficiaries are neither poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or other programs that help low-income people, nor well-off enough to escape financial worries. They're the people in the middle. They do benefit from the valuable financial protection Medicare offers. But between premiums, co-pays, coverage gaps, other living expenses, limited savings, and a congressional debate about Medicare that may lead to higher out-of-pocket costs, that protection seems more fragile than ever. I'm Jackie Judd with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you, Priscilla. Thank you, Georgia. And thank you, Darlene and Robert. We are now going to turn to what might be the funner part of our program, just to be honest. We are so happy to have with us Bruce Vladek and Gail Walensky. I think it is fair to say that we have two national Medicare treasures with us, both with unmatched expertise in what you might call the three P's of Medicare. They're looking at me like, what would that be? programmatic management. They have both been administrators of what we now call the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, back in the day called HCFA. And to be the administrator of HCFA or CMS, you have to understand how to manage the program and deal with the nitty-gritty challenges. They are also quite expert in the policy issues facing Medicare, which is what we're going to talk a great deal about today. And I think it is also fair to say that they have also paid their dues in the politics of Medicare. So we are really, really thrilled to have them. Dr. Gail Walensky is an economist. She is a senior fellow at Project Hope. She served as administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration under the first President Bush between 1990 and 1992. During her tenure, she dealt with many of the issues that are still around us today, and she testifies frequently. She is called upon often for her expert advice. She was chair of MedPAC for several years. She is clearly a Medicare expert. We are so happy to have you here. Bruce followed Gail to the Healthcare Financing Administration, where he served under President Clinton. After his stint at HCFA, he went on to spend some time working with the National Bipartisan Commission on the Future of Medicare, where he dealt with many of the issues, such as premium support, that we're talking about today. Currently, Bruce is a senior advisor to Nexera, which is a consulting subsidiary to the Greater New York Hospital Association. He's also chairman of the Medicare Rights Center Board, and we are very, very happy to have him with us. So we have two highly regarded Medicare experts with us, and so now I'm going to switch to my more Oprah position to engage in a little bit of a discussion.
These chairs need to come with footstools for us short people.
Exactly. Right. The way this is going to work, I'm going to start and ask some questions, and then after a while, I hope you will raise your questions. I'm going to give you some time to think through what you want to ask. I'm going to start. First I'm going to give you each a chance to kind of make a few opening comments. There's been a lot in the news about Medicare, and I'm wondering if you have thoughts that you'd want to just put on the table to get going. Why don't we start? Gail, do you want to start?
Sure. And thank you, Tricia, also for warning me not to wear a skirt today. I appreciate that. See the problems that would have resulted.
We have to take care of each other.
I want to make a couple of points that seem to get lost in the cracks in all the discussion that is going on, which has a lot of heat. The first is that the notion of trying to stabilize Medicare for the long term far precedes our current economic recession. And I think it's really important. Most of the people in the room probably know that. Those of us up here have certainly had many debates and discussions about the long-term financial viability of Medicare. And that's really, when I talk about issues in Medicare, I want to focus on the kinds of issues that I think are important in order to get long-term sustainability for a program that has had serious challenges for the last couple of decades. First and foremost, because historically spending has grown substantially faster than the economy, and secondarily exacerbated by the shifting demographics that's going to roughly double the population on Medicare by the time the baby boomers finish retiring. As people know, the first of the official baby boomers started to retire in January of this year. It will go on for 20 years, and when we end up, we will roughly double, not quite, but almost double the population on Medicare. But that's not the most serious problem. I think we could deal with that increase in the population. It is how to get a growth rate in Medicare that is sustainable. So that's the first point. Second point is, as part of the Affordable Care Act, which has many aspects that I support, particularly the expansion of coverage, but many other aspects that have caused me great distress, which is the lack of reforming the delivery system. The Affordable Care Act has already impacted Medicare to the extent that it is actually carried out in a major way for the next decade, mainly by reducing payments in a pretty significant way. I raise the issue about whether it'll be carried out because, as most of you know, Rick Foster, the CMS actuary, has repeatedly questioned whether the out years in the payment reductions are likely to occur because of access problems that are going to rise, he believes, because there has not really been a change in the dynamics in the incentives in the program. And the third point that I want to make is that there is some discussion, but not very open, clear discussion about the notion of whether or not we are proposing to change Medicare in a significant way. And my response would be, we actually leapt over that discussion without seeming to involve the American public very much in that discussion. And that is, Medicare has traditionally been an open-ended entitlement where we spend what we spend according to how people respond. Part B of Medicare, the physician payment, had the mechanism to not do that because it had tied the rate of the increase in the update to what happened in total spending. But as you all know, we've never actually used that mechanism other than in 2002 when payments were reduced by 4.5%. But now, in a not very explicit way, the Democrats, and in a much more explicit way, the Republicans, have embraced the concept of limiting spending on Medicare. Congressman Ryan made clear in his discussion, his proposal, I'll be glad to talk about that later, about the rate of growth at CPI. I think that's too stringent and reasonable. We don't have to redo the sustainable growth rate experience. We know what happens when we put in law an unrealistic rate of increase. But he clearly put that out there. But the fact is, the Democrats have as well. People just didn't seem to realize, baked into the Affordable Care Act, are assumptions about total spending to be imposed by the Independent Payment Advisory Board if they don't happen, which they won't happen, in my view, because of the other changes that are in place. And President Obama has actually upped the ante a bit in his proposals of saying we should keep Medicare spending growing at no more than 0.75 of 1% of GDP. So what has happened is that both parties have just embraced this very different concept of Medicare without really talking about, if we were going to limit spending, how should we do so? And as a policy person, that's, of course, where I want to jump in and say, we can do it this way. The Democrats have proposed of limiting reimbursements on providers of Medicare. Or we can try to change the dynamics, which is how I would describe the move toward premium support, a modified Ryan plan, a federal employees health model, however you want to describe it.
Don't keep saying federal employees health model is having anything to do with the Ryan plan, Gail. It is just one of those sound bites that distorts the debate. I'm sorry. It's just not at all like it.
Well, we can discuss that. I'll say why it's different and why it isn't. It's certainly not exactly like it. And the question of whether, I mean, it's what you think are the characteristics that you think are important of that or a premium support plan. But anyway, as I've said, and as I've written clearly, I don't support what Congressman Ryan has proposed as it is written. I support what I would regard as a modified Ryan plan, and you could decide with those modifications whether you think that is an FEHB-like program or not. I do not support the Ryan plan as it was stated, but I do support what I think is something in the spirit of the Ryan plan as opposed to what is being pursued currently. And again, people can decide whether the nomenclature suits them or not.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to some of the specifics here. Bruce, do you want to make some general comments?
I just want to make three points relatively briefly. First, I couldn't agree more that the long-term threat to the well-being of Medicare program arises from the rate of growth in costs. But I would be a little more specific than that. The most serious long-term threat to the well-being of the Medicare program has been the inability to date of the private sector to control private sector costs. There is a bit of movement in that direction, people hope, in the Affordable Care Act. But if private sector costs, Medicare is already growing more slowly than private sector costs and will be throughout the 10-year budget window of the Affordable Care Act, as Tricia's slide showed. The problem is if private, and it's been our problem for the last two decades, if private sector costs continue to grow at rates nearly as quickly as they have, Medicare essentially has two choices and is always walking the tightrope between sort of keeping up in a way that causes long-term enormous financial consequences, negative for the program, or of tolerating a growing gap between what Medicare pays and what private insurers pay, or privately insured people pay, since increasingly it's the insured out of pocket making those payments, which runs a serious risk of creating problems in access to physicians. I think on the hospital sector, because Medicare beneficiaries are so large, a proportion of hospital inpatients, the effect is different, but no less bad. If you get a substantially greater differential than now exists between what privately insured people pay and what Medicare pays, you put rural hospitals, many inner-city institutions, many academic institutions, which are particularly reliant on Medicare, in a very uncompetitive position in terms of maintaining the same level of service for their patients that hospitals in more affluent communities begin to have. And that's true across a range of providers as well. So long-term, there is no... On the other hand, if we don't control private sector costs, we're in much worse trouble than just having to bail Medicare out again and again. And that's sort of got to be the key to any strategy in this regard. And one of the frustrations in my professional activity over the last number of years, if you're talking about Medicare, you're not allowed to talk about cost containment more generally, but we need to do that for the well-being of the Medicare program. The second is to put the current Medicare crisis in perspective. I had the opportunity to testify at the Senate Finance Committee last week, and I told the members of the committee that my principal reaction, other than being pleased and honored to be there, was an enormous sense of deja vu, because I had sat at exactly the same table in 1996 and been confronted with all the talk about the unsustainability of Medicare and the budget crisis of the government and so on and so forth. In fact, we enacted the Balanced Budget Act. In fact, in the year 2000, we overdid it in the Balanced Budget Act because the CBO screwed up all the numbers, but we were looking at a $1 trillion surplus in the federal budget in the year 2000. We were looking at 28 years in the expected future life of the Medicare Trust Fund. And something has happened in the intervening decade that is causing this great financial crisis in the federal government, and it's not anything having to do with Medicare. It's critical that we restore some degree of balance to the federal budget, but I think we need to focus on what, in fact, changed in the overall structure of the finances of the federal government in the last decade, which is mostly a fall in the proportion of the GDP that supports federal revenues from about 18% in 2000 to under 15% today. And frankly, I'm personally terrified that the current administration won't be insistent enough about addressing that problem as part of a long-term solution to the budget problems. The third thing I would say, and it's really very important, and I was thinking about the slide that was shown earlier about Medicare as a percent of GDP. This also has to do with the overall status of the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, the overall state of the federal budget, and so forth. And obviously, Medicare as a percent of GDP is an arithmetic computation with two variables in it. One is Medicare spending, the other is GDP. It's remarkable what the impact is on the social insurance programs of economic growth. And anyone who thinks they can predict what the economy, the rate of growth in the economy is going to be 3 years from now, let alone 75 years from now, is a very, very effective salesman or has a tie to another reality of the kind that I've never been able to identify. And the whole fact of the matter is that a critical part of all these projections, and I mean, between the 2010 trustees report and the 2011 trustees report of the hospital insurance trust fund, the expected remaining life of the Medicare trust fund shrank by 4 years, not from any change whatsoever in Medicare policy, but because the economy has significantly underperformed the projections of a year ago, especially in terms of employment, since Part A is financed by a payroll tax. So I think it's important, as we talk about deficit reduction, to really sort of keep our eyes on the ball, and the ball is revenues of the federal government and economic growth. The other reason that Medicare is a rising share of GDP is because we've basically stripped everything else out of the federal government except defense and debt service. And so there are many vitally important services and functions that the federal government used to pay for that it no longer does or no longer does to anywhere like the same extent. Everyone's all abuzz at the moment about how we don't have enough physicians to meet the demand of an aging economy, let alone of all the additional people that are going to have coverage under the Affordable Care Act. At the same time that the federal financial support for health professions education has almost disappeared from the federal budget. So I think, again, in the context of a budget debate, where Medicare is a contributor to the problem and where Medicare is an object of the problem needs to be made sufficiently clear. And in the long term, we're going to have to get a handle on all of health care costs, or we're all ruined, whatever happens to Medicare in that instance.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to now try to focus on some specific Medicare policy proposals that have come on board. And I don't think we can quite do this. I was thinking of a speed dating where I'd ask a question and have a rapid response because the concepts are pretty complicated. But I would like to get your thoughts on some of the ideas that we've talked about or that have been talked about. And one of them is raising the age of Medicare eligibility. That was mentioned in several of the proposals. I think the Senator Lieberman, who may have an announcement coming out this afternoon, has talked about that. We've taken a look at it here. What are your thoughts about raising the age of eligibility for Medicare?
Well, I support it, but I don't think it's, I mean, it will only give you so much, and I support it with qualification. The first is people need to understand that the younger seniors do not spend as much as the average and certainly not as much as the people in their 80s and 90s. So you don't have an average Medicare saving. But I think for many reasons, the notion of moving the age of expected retirement out is appropriate. We have, over a very long time, done it with Social Security. I think 70 is better than 67, and the question of how fast. The qualification is that while most people in their mid-60s are able to continue working, there is an uptick in the number of people who cannot work because of disability, and you clearly need to have allowances for people to become fully on Medicare if they are unable to continue working at full Medicare. And so acknowledging that this is something that the last time I looked, the numbers were about 20%, 22% in the 63, 65 range that are not able. But that means basically that 80-something.
I guess assuming health reform is implemented, where people in their mid-60s could have access to coverage in the exchange and the subsidies, to some extent, that particular worry could go away, but are there other concerns that you might have?
Well, I mean, right now people would say, well, you know, where are we going to get all the jobs? And the answer as an economist is I don't disagree with the point that a lot of these issues become different, look different when you have a robust economy. And there's a lot of debate about what it will take in order to get a robust economy. And economists differ according to their own predilections and their political parties. But the idea of saying, oh, we don't want to try to encourage people to be working out into the 70s because there are not enough jobs is just a terrible argument. Job sharing as a forced idea to try to share a finite number of jobs periodically comes up when you have recessions and depressions. It is a terrible idea. The right answer is, no, you got to figure out how to generate economic growth and jobs that will get you out of a lot of problems. So I do support it. I think you have to have clear recognition that some people will not be able to work because of disability. You have to have fiscal policies that encourage that kind of activity and also have insurance available through exchanges or some kind of structure for the market. If we continue on employer-sponsored insurance, you might want to think about whether there's something you want to do to make it more attractive for the employers.
Bruce?
Well, I totally agree with Gail that it's very important in every way that we think of we can encourage people who are physically able to remain in the workforce longer. I mean, if you're really serious about 20, 30-year projections, you have to keep people in their late 60s and 70s in the workforce, or the other thing which causes great political, the only other way to have enough workers is to reopen immigration very broadly, which is okay with me too, but not a very popular thing in this city.
Actually,
so,
okay with me too.
I'm absolutely for it. I think if the implementation of the ACA is stalled or significantly impeded, then you'd really have a real problem with people not becoming eligible for Medicare at 65. Not only those who are disabled, but essentially everyone over the age of 65 who's not employed in the absence of an exchange and a mechanism like it will be uninsurable. And those are folks who are in the least desirable position to be uninsured. But if you have an option, I think there's no reason not to do it. The only point to point out is that as a society, moving the Eligibility Age Act so that people in their late 60s have private health insurance rather than Medicare may be a perfectly good thing on a number of criteria, but doesn't save us any money at all. It's just an accounting device, basically. And as the estimates seem to be, that it obviously saves Medicare money, but most of those savings are counteracted by higher costs encountered by either the insured folks themselves and or their employers. Now, it may well be if the only thing you care about is the numbers in the federal budget, that's perfectly okay. But in terms of the economics of health care expenditures altogether, it really doesn't save any significant amount of money.
Okay. I think I just have to ask about premium support. It's sort of the elephant in the room. I'm guessing that there's going to be a different point of view about premium support. But I also feel that we ought to at least be clear about what we're talking about, because there is the House plan, the Ryan proposal, which some people call premium support, others have called vouchers. There is this issue that just emerged when you all were talking about, is this idea really like the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program? Is it really like Part D, or is it not? What are some of the important differences, if there are? Gail, I know you've written about different ways that you would structure premium support. I don't know whether I could even ask, is there like any element of premium support that you would both agree is a good idea? So I think I'm just going to ask you both to sort of give us your thoughts about the premium support debate, whether or not you think it works, whether or not there are some issues in setting caps per capita spending, as the House bill would do, or whether you would structure it differently?
Well, I'm somebody who has advocated what I have labeled as a federal employees health plan model for many years. I was looking back, the very first article I wrote in Health Affairs in 1982 was commenting on Alan Enthoven's proposed plan, which I would regard as a premium support and federal health plan model type program. The last line was altogether not a bad idea. And Alan Entoven and I have been friends now for 30 years because he liked that I said that. So this is a long-time belief of mine, and I will explain what I regard as the main characteristics, but I won't argue that there are differences in various plans, and you can call it whatever you like, although probably not a voucher. I probably would not accept that. The important elements are a variety of health plans that differ in a number of dimensions. To me, as I've suggested in the New England Journal article I wrote, and I have suggested previously when I proposed a Medicare reform with Joe Newhouse at the end of the 1990s, is that one of those plans be traditional Medicare. There is no reason that you can't view traditional Medicare on a premium basis. It is going to be out there anyway, and for a lot of reasons that would give people comfort. So I would say a wide variety of private plans, but no reason not to include traditional Medicare. The fundamental concept that makes it a premium support or an FEHB-like plan is whatever the subsidy is, it's the same whichever plan is chosen. Now, in the federal employees health plan model, it is a fixed percentage. In a better model, that is a stronger incented model, it's a fixed dollar subsidy that doesn't vary according to what plan somebody chooses, from traditional Medicare to any of the plans that are allowed into the program. There have to be some rules of the game. And then the question is, how do you set the amount? As people know, in the FEHB world, you look at the four most popular plans, and 72% of the weighted average of that premium is what the subsidy is, and that percentage continues on. A better one is to do, again, a stronger premium support is to have a fixed dollar amount rather than a percentage. And the idea is, how do you set that? With Congressman Ryan, it was estimated at what the federal dollar contribution would be in Medicare for 65-year-olds in 2022. What I think is important, and have said this in the past, is the amount that is set has to purchase something. So there has to be a third test on there that says, if you initially start out that this is an amount, 80%, 90% of a plan in an area that you start, there's got to be at least a plan going forward in an area that meets that. So you either can set the rate each year by some mechanism, or you can have requirements that there has to be a plan available that meets whatever requirements are, you know, that a subsidy covers 80% or 90% of the cost of the plan in a market, and if not, you need to revise the subsidy. So for me, the really critical concept are a variety of healthcare plans, private, but again, I'd say in the Medicare population, no reason not to have the Medicare plan. You have to have rules about what qualifies. The most important notion is that you have either a fixed dollar or a fixed percentage subsidy contribution that doesn't vary according to the plan that is chosen, and that means that people who choose more expensive plans will pay that difference, and people who choose less expensive plans will have even more of their plan covered than whatever is set as the expected share. Again, a lot of issues about regulations and how you implement that. I think the notion of adjusting the amount so that sicker and poorer people get more money, which we've been gradually building into Medicare, kind of in these, you know, sideways way we do things, where we have the extra support for Part D and we have the Quimby Slimby for people who are low income but not low income enough to get Medicaid, and then we have Medicaid, which, as was discussed in the paper yesterday, has the characteristic for the dual eligibles as being very expensive, very badly coordinated care. You could do a much better job if you provided a lot more support for low-income sick people. That's how I would describe it.
Tricia, as part of your question, you asked if there are any things I liked about the FEHBP model, and I would say two. One is that the federal government would pay 72% of the costs of Medicare beneficiaries now encounter. We'd be way ahead. I mean, it's now less than 50% on average. So that's an enormous boon, and that would be appropriate, I think. That's our model for health insurance. The other thing I like about the FEHB plan is the notion of having a single federal official directly accountable to the President of the United States negotiate on the terms and details and conditions and prices of the benchmark plans. I think that would be an excellent idea. Apart from that, though, the debate about premium support continues to astonish me because it shows how in certain areas of public policy discourse in this city and elsewhere, the abstract faith in a theoretical notion trumps 25 years of very solid empirical evidence. We've been paying what we now call Medicare Advantage plans and Medicare Advantage was supposed to be designed very similar to what Gail described, that is, let's make basically a fixed dollar amount available for private plans while keeping traditional Medicare in place. And we have 25 years' worth of experience where if you set a benchmark at the federal government's contribution, risk-adjusted on average, to the coverage of an average Medicare beneficiary, the private sector can't perform. They can't meet the basic benefit package. And that's because they don't have the economies of scale of a national program, and mostly because they have to pay for marketing and enrollment and stealing beneficiaries away from one another and network maintenance and all the other things that a single national program has enormous advantages in providing. So, I mean, even in the midst of concerns about deficit reduction and so on and so forth, and the biggest savings in Medicare achieved in the Affordable Care Act were, in fact, an effort to bring the premiums that we're now paying on average to Medicare Advantage plans closer, if not identical, to the government's annual contribution to traditional fee-for-service Medicare, and the howls of complaint from rural senators and congressmen are ceaseless. So the fact is we've been trying to move the Medicare program in this direction since TEFRA was enacted. At the moment, we have a level of generosity in our payment of Medicare in the size of the voucher and the way in which we set the voucher that we probably will never be able to afford to achieve again. 75% of beneficiaries are still in traditional Medicare. And the plans have made it very clear that unless we pay them more than we pay for average fee-for-service Medicare, they're not going to participate. So give me a break. I mean, I've been hearing these same arguments on how competition among private plans would bring down costs and empower consumers, and we've been moving in that direction for 25 years, and all the evidence is to the contrary that that'll work.
We have just not done it. And it was, I mean, the part that's
so frustrating. No, we never do it right. We never do it perfectly. After the fact, the economists always say, if you'd only done this and plugged this into here, then it would have been fine.
But it was,
and so we keep trying, and it keeps not
working. It was in the 2003 legislation. I mean, it's so frustrating. Exactly what I was proposing was in the 2003 Medicare modernization. It said that in areas where there was at least 25% penetration of people in private plans in Medicare, starting in 2010, we should have basically the world that I was describing, traditional Medicare and private plans. They ought to be paid at the same level. And then let people choose. I don't understand if it's so obvious that people won't want to do this. Why is there this constant fight against trying it? It was just an anathema in then to say, have these on the same grounds. It's like, don't pay them more. I'm not arguing. I mean, I argue, have for the last at least two decades, it's not the government's business whether somebody wants to take a private plan or traditional Medicare. They ought to be structured so they're comparable. They ought to have comparable reporting requirements. Let people choose the plan that suits them best. And if it's traditional Medicare, that's fine with me. Don't distort it. Don't bias it. I don't understand why there is so much resistance against seeing this. What I observed in the late 1990s, when there was a huge pushback against managed care, which, by the way, had been very successful in terms of slowing spending on Medicare in the middle 1990s, the one place you didn't see it was in Washington and in people who were part of the Federal Employees Health Plan, which I attributed it to the fact that every November people got to choose their health care plan, and if they thought their insurance plan was not treating them appropriately, giving them access to specialists, or in any other way treating them as they wanted to, they could vote with their feet. And that ability relieves a lot of pressure. So why is there so much resistance against trying this?
I don't think there's resistance against trying it. I think that's what we did in the Balanced Budget Act, was we tried to move Medicare Advantage premiums to a level equal to average fee-for-service
costs. But never a direct, here, we're going to pay a premium. Everybody pays by those rules, traditional Medicare on a premium basis, and the private plans. Why is that so difficult to say? It will be just like one of the other plans in the offering, and people will be able to see that. I mean, that's really an important attribute as well. This is the subsidy you're going to get. You, because of your age and your illness and your income, and here are the private plans or traditional Medicare that you can choose, and here's the difference. Here are the benefits you get. Here's the difference you'll have to pay in premium. Here are the coinsurance, very much in the way that we see.
Among the reasons that didn't happen is because Congress would never permit traditional Medicare to have a marketing budget. But and to think that people can have free choice if you have the largest player in the field forbidden from conducting activities which are protected under the First Amendment by all its competitors already starts to give you a very skewed kind of market.
It's hard to see for me to look or to see that the government doesn't play up Medicare, whichever party happens to be around. But, I mean, that seems to me like a pretty flimsy reason not to adopt a strategy that at least brings in a lot more willingness maybe to consider putting constraints in place than you otherwise have. And if you have traditional Medicare as one of the plans there, it just seems to me you really diffuse a lot of the concerns that are otherwise raised. So as I've said, I just find it a mystery about why there's just not a willingness to try it. And I'm very frustrated because we would be already going into the second year of knowing what happens in selected markets.
Let me just ask one question. Would you support offering traditional Medicare through the exchanges to people below the age of 65?
Not until I try it first here. I mean, that was why if we can't do it in Medicare, where we already have them, then, I mean, I want to try this here. We've already got this app. Let it go here, and then we'll see.
All right, I'm going to try to get a word in edgewise here. And actually what I want to do is invite you all to ask questions. So I'm going to try to ask one question while you all get organized. Raise your hand. There are people walking around the room with microphones. And anybody's ready, we can start now. Otherwise, I have a lot of questions I haven't even started to ask. Help me out, guys.
Hi, Mike Miller. Bruce brought up the point about the private sector not controlling costs to the same extent as Medicare. And there's one part of the ACA that you guys didn't touch on, and it's a little bit controversial now, but it's the whole Medicare Shared Savings Program and the growth of ACOs. And that program is supposed to pull together Medicare and the private sector's payers' interests. And it also can lead to something like, I don't know what you call premium support, but if you get towards capitation to the delivery systems, you're getting into a system that's not just fee-for-service. Is that a way to bridge the gap and to move forward in a way that people could agree upon if presumably Medicare and the delivery systems can make it work?
Well, I would phrase it differently, but I'll try to respond to your question. for me, one of the real problems of traditional Medicare has been it is a very fragmented, siloed system that is heavily fee-for-service oriented and not very conducive to the coordinated care important for taking care of elderly people or people with chronic disease, and that has been a major problem along with the incentives of do more and more complex, get paid more. That is not a good set of incentives if you're trying to moderate spending. My frustration in general with the Affordable Care Act is most of the action, the legislative action, has been on reducing payments to what I regard as a pretty dysfunctional delivery system that exists in Medicare, with whatever changes are out there mostly embedded in the pilots as yet to be defined by the Innovation Center. The Accountable Care Organization was one of the legislated areas which unfortunately should have been in a pilot, in my view, because we don't know what we're talking about yet, that attempts to allow for different incentives to exist, allowing physicians as across physician type or physicians with hospitals to come together who are not formally integrated and to share savings if they are able to produce savings in a way that would violate the Stark and other existing laws if they were to do outside of the Affordable Care Organization, the Accountable Care Organization structure. The idea, I've been dubious as to how successful it would be for two reasons. The first is it seems pretty tough to get this done even when you have enrollment models, although Geisinger, where I am now on the board, and Kaiser Intermountain Healthcare certainly have a lot of suggestive evidence that they can do better. So I was a little dubious about whether a non-enrollment model would actually be able to work. We've seen now also proposed regulations which seem to, say, not be engendering a lot of interest and support, so whether we'll actually see many of these form is less clear. The idea is a good idea, which is to break away from the current really unhelpful incentives in traditional Medicare of get more income by doing more and more complex, not get rewarded or rewarded very little by either providing higher quality, and particularly higher quality at lower cost, unless you are in a capitated or Medicare Advantage plan where you can reap some of those benefits.
Do you want
to? Yeah, I agree with much of what Gail's saying, although, again, the rhetoric and the inside the beltway way of talking about things really sort of makes me slightly crazy. She talks about how the Medicare system is sort of fragmented and there's no coordination of care and it's mostly fee-for-service. That's the American healthcare system, folks. Unless you live in California or Danville, Pennsylvania, that's the health system that you live in. And, in fact, 90% of the private managed care plans in the United States use a variant of the Medicare fee schedule, which Gail is, in many ways, one of the real founding mothers of, as the basis for how they pay physicians. Everybody bases on percent of Medicare on an RBRVS basis. So the problem is that there's no disagreement that it would be a wonderful thing to significantly reform the delivery system in the United States in order to get better, more coordinated care to people. I continue to be very skeptical whether net will save a nickel in the process, but it's very important for people of all ages and of all insurance status to get substantially better care than they now do in this country when they have complicated illnesses requiring multidisciplinary attention or whatever. The problem with that is that real honest-to-goodness systems reform takes a very long time, and it takes a kind of concentrated, focused, and generous kind of national leadership that we don't have, that we've never had, and that a majority of the House of Representatives and of the healthcare professionals wouldn't stand for even if it existed. So In the meantime, we're going to have to nurture as carefully and as sort of aggressively as we can the little buds of innovation that are sprouting up here and there. And it's very important that the people who run Medicare and Medicaid not stomp on them in their young, delicate kind of weight of growth. But the fact of the matter is that 30 years ago, we looked at Kaiser and we looked at the Mayo Clinic, which at the time got most of its business on a fee-for-service basis, and said this is the way we ought to reorganize the healthcare system. And the system hasn't reorganized itself spontaneously in those intervening years. In fact, many of its worst uncoordinated, autonomous, disorganized characteristics have been substantially accelerated by all the money we've pumped into it over the last 30 years. There's if we're going to really change the way we deliver care in this country, we haven't even begun to talk seriously about how we're going to do that.
My name is Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. I will be eligible for Medicare myself next year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I've submitted something to the Kaiser Health News suggesting that we reduce the difference between what specialists are paid and what cognitive specialists are paid via the RBRVS system. But my question is for Ms. Walensky. I think the SGR is coming up again. The organized medicine position is just pay us all more. That's not going to happen. I think you suggested several years ago that we have different SGRs for different things, maybe one for procedures and one for cognitive physicians, maybe another one for imaging studies or labs or drugs. But it was a long time ago, and I don't remember if, in fact, you actually did it.
Well, let me explain what I have been railing against the RBRVS, then volume performance standard, now SGR, since I was involved in implementing it. I always regarded it as being especially ironic that somebody who was so against price controls at a micro level got to be there when it was being implemented and had to spend 90% of my waking hours worrying about whether it was going to happen on time, because that
was my
job. And
you did a brilliant job.
Thank
you.
I have been, for the last decade, trying to push the Congress hard about the importance of changing how we reimburse physicians and moving away from reimbursing for 7,000 different items and then thinking you're going to keep it intact by having a spending limit, which then goes down to the individual fees. My preferred strategy to fix it is to move Medicare more in the direction that we have moved all other parts of Medicare, which is in terms of bundled payments. It's what we've done for inpatient and now outpatients. It's what we've done for nursing homes and especially for home care with the episodes of payment, where you worry about the proper price for a bundle of service. You allow the provider much more discretion about what gets done within that service. And in terms of the general direction in terms of physicians ought to be for high-cost, high-volume interventions, of which there are a limited number, and for chronic care. At the very least, we need to have bundles of payment so that you don't have somebody billing for everything they do with regard to diabetes, education and lab testing, and the visits to the doctor, or for a bypass surgery where you have many physicians involved and with an expensive hospital intervention. That's my preferred strategy, because then you would have a very different argument about, well, how much ought it to cost to take care of somebody with diabetes or somebody who have diabetes and congestive heart failure for a year or for somebody who goes in to have an expensive intervention. If you can't get yourself to do that, the only kind of SGR that makes sense to me is actually much more micro level than what you described. It would be at the practice level. Now, I mean, it may sound radical, but there's no reason you couldn't do that. It's not that different from what Germany some years ago, I'm not sure if they're still doing it, used. And the reason this would fundamentally change how you think about the way physicians are reimbursed is what happens to your update reflects the kind of behavior your practice engages in. Now, if you have very small practices, you have some problems about whether you need to do some kind of adjustment for variance. Mm-hmm. Any kind of practice that you're now talking 4 or 5 physicians, that's probably not going to be such a big issue. If you had the limit of how much update you get depending on the behavior of the practice, then you get, for me as an economist, a relationship between what happens and what you do. My fundamental problem with the SGR is that no one group or physician can actually affect what happens, no matter how egregious you are or how conservative you are, and yet you get impacted by what your group does. And even if you had it at your metropolitan level, I mean, think about practicing in Washington, D.C., and your fate, if you're a cardiologist or if you're an internist or a primary care physician of another sort, is it going to depend on what all of the other cardiologists in Washington do, as though you have some kind of influence over them? That will just never be regarded as equitable. And so it's either bundle the reimbursement or take the SGR or the spending limit down to the level of the actual practice. Then you will at least get people's attention so that what they do influences how they are reimbursed in the future.
I agree entirely. Absolutely. She's absolutely right.
There are areas where we do agree on.
Well, let me try one then, see if you agree on this one.
Don't push it now.
No, I think prospect here. There's been a lot of discussion about the Independent Payment Advisory Board, the IPAB, and whether it is an appropriate vehicle for constraining the growth in Medicare spending. Of all the things in the health reform law, this one has gotten quite a bit of attention of late. I know one member of Congress has said this will kill seniors. I mean, this is really kind of hit the skids. So I'm wondering, is this an area where you might agree? What do you think about the IPAB?
I suspect we won't agree. I don't like the IPAB.
I don't either.
I don't like it. I'm sympathetic with why people have proposed it. Frustration at the Congress not being either to delegate to the administration more authority, my most favorite strategy, or do it themselves in terms about deciding how to restrain spending. To me, what they have done is have a cure that's worse than the disease, to allocate this kind of authority, which can have a very important impact on access and how care is delivered, to a group of 15 people that, once appointed, are completely unaccountable to anybody. As I've said, for me, that is, I understand why they've taken the position, but it's a cure worse than the disease. So either do it yourself, allocate it to an accountable group. The CMS administrator can be fired or dismissed or not confirmed. Reporting to a secretary that can have the same fate, reporting to a president who every 4 years is accountable to the American people. So that is, I mean, I don't like the IPAB. That is just a bad strategy.
Bruce?
I agree entirely.
Okay, we got
I should probably leave it
just,
there.
Just to show that this is not just fatigue on my part. That, I've noted in the course of this session, as is often the case, and is perfectly appropriate, Gail has several times prefaced responses by saying, as an economist, since I can now say as a political scientist who studied constitutional theory and the history of regulatory agencies in graduate school, it's hard to imagine this day and age anyone would think of the Interstate Commerce Commission as a model for how to make better Medicare policy, but it's the same sort of political dynamic as well. And I particularly agree with the notion that there is no sort of fundamental legal constitutional reason at the moment why the Congress, instead of doing what it does every 3 or 4 years in reconciliation level, down to the fourth decimal point, couldn't say, and CMS shall take $2 billion out of lab and $4 billion out of DME and so on and so forth. And in fact, you'd probably get much better policy in the process. The problem with the IPAB is the Congress wanting to have it both ways, and that just is not good sort of government. I mean, it just is a way of hiding behind an instrumentality that, in fact, they will overrule when the heat is enough anyway, and that they will do everything they can once it's created to corrupt the way all the so-called independent regulatory bodies have been corrupt, have been captured by the industries they're supposed to regulate. So just why go to all that trouble and expense to make things more complicated and no better is not clear to me. That's consistent.
Well, this truly is an area where we have strong agreement.
I know. I'm wondering if I should leave it on a high note. I have a few other questions. Microphones. Why aren't our colleagues there?
David Raven at Georgetown. I think there is agreement that health care costs are unsustainable. They're twice what other nations experience. They're associated with poorer health status than other developed nations experience. Other developed nations have near or complete universal access to health care. They also have some version of a single-payer system. How is it possible to believe that our unique system, other nations also agree that what happens under private health insurance is inequity, poorer health status, and rising health care costs? How is it possible to believe that we, in our exceptional way, have the answer, unlike the experience of every other developed nation?
Let me just start out with the facts. Many countries with universal health insurance have very robust and large private sector, private insurance companies. Most Germans are insured by private insurance companies. Most of the Dutch these days are insured by private insurance companies. Those are two of sort of the model welfare states where Americans should only be so lucky as to have the entitlements either the Dutch or the Germans ever have. So that's, I mean, I think that's a misstatement. The real issue, though, is to me, is the following. I don't think you can control health care costs unless you take the position in one way or another that the rate of health care costs most conveniently reflected through premiums throughout the whole market is a matter of public concern. I don't think you need to do a single payer. I don't need you need to set rates identically for private insurers and others. I think if you have a mechanism like an exchange where people who will do poorly in experience-rated markets can be in a community-rated market, that'll drive up overall costs, but it's a good halfway measure. But I think the real problem is we have, in the name of decentralization and individual freedom and individual entrepreneurism, created a market that is inherently enormously inflationary. As long as that market continues to be organized the way that it is, we're never going to be able to get a control of health care costs in this country, because with the degree to which income is unevenly distributed in this country and the degree to which income and health status are inversely correlated, then health care providers or health care insurers who are motivated primarily by economic incentives, which is some of them, will find a way to make their services available only to those who can afford to pay a premium by charging premium prices and maximize their incomes in the process. And then once that's off and running, everyone else is playing catch-up. So I think if we're ever going to get a control of health care costs, we're going to have to say in one way or another. And the exchanges are a very modest but very productive step in that direction. And I think that in the context of the other changes occurring in the private health insurance market, we are going to begin to see some more efforts on the part of employers and private insurers to do something about health care costs rather than just shift them to the insured population. But unless there is a public policy somewhere that says not just the cost of government programs, but health care costs in general have to be subject to some kind of limitation or some kind of control, we're never going to control.
I agree with parts, not entirely, but I'm not going to go that direction as much to try to respond to the gist of some of what you've just said. The first is most countries have universal coverage. Access is frequently an issue, even with universal coverage. It is a good reminder, of course, we know that here, that coverage, insurance coverage per se, frequently, or at least sometimes doesn't, provide you with access. It's just the next step. So we shouldn't, having spent a few years working with the World Health Organization and the social determinants of health and looking at the impact of determinants other than medical care on health and on the issues of access to that health care, let's not get too carried away with that. The second is it's fundamentally a political decision. I don't know that I can be more obvious than that. When we had the discussion in this country in 2009, there was a fledgling movement in the House with the same 77 congressmen that are usually trying to push single payer. It basically went no. It was those 77. In 2008, Dennis Kucinich was the only candidate who was embracing a single-payer system. He did not do very well. It is a political issue about how we want to take on these issues. With regard to the insurance exchange, I have a lot of agreement with Bruce that it is a very important potential mechanism to resolve a lot of issues, including the fact that we've had, in a secular sense, declining employer-sponsored insurance that's been quite notable since the 1980s, and we need to have another mechanism for people to be able to get insurance in a structured market organizing entity with some kind of subsidies. Now, I worry a little that the exchanges may be too limited and that they may be too regulatory in the nature. But I like insurance exchanges in general because you need to have some kind of an organizing mechanism for people to buy insurance and to make sure the insurance is fair that's being bought. It could end up being that mechanism that really allows us to move away from employer-sponsored insurance, but hopefully in an orderly fashion, and to be an alternative for people who don't have employer-sponsored insurance, which has always been a big issue. People who work for firms that don't offer insurance or who are in and out of the labor market, and for people who are on Medicaid. I'm hoping that maybe some of the newly enfranchised Medicaid individuals, especially those above the poverty line, might be able to buy insurance in the exchange rather than be on their state Medicaid program. So it could be a way for us to do it differently. We are different than most of the European countries. There are very few that begin to have the diversity we have in terms of ethnic, religious, racial backgrounds, and try to think about the health plan that could get through the EU. That's a lot closer to what we face. It's a little exaggerated, but it's a lot closer to what we face as a country than looking at many others. I was in a meeting last year when people were touting all of the wonderful things that were going on social determinants of Sweden. And finally, I couldn't say, all right, tell me exactly how many people live in Sweden. And I think the number was either 7 or 9 million. I can't quite remember.
And they're almost all Swedish,
too. Yeah, that was my other, yeah. Is that, you mean like if we could only get, say, Minnesota or Oregon to act in a coherent way. It's like, think about what it would take for New York or Florida or California, yet alone all those other places to come together. So it really is not quite fair to say they can, why don't we?
All right, well, we are about out of time. I'm going to ask you one more question, final question, because I said you're experts in politics too. Do you see Medicare as an issue in the next election?
Sure.
Or shall this all fade away?
No. Well, I mean, Medicare and health care, to some extent, are always issues in our elections. I wish they would be able to carry over after the election into serious discussions about what we're willing to do different and what that might look like and how do we make that happen. Sometimes there are relatively serious discussions about health care in the elections. I actually thought 2008 was one of our better years in campaign where we had some rational discussions about health care. It's sustaining that afterward that's difficult. We do better when the majorities are close than if they're too skewed one direction or the other. It may make it easier to pass legislation when they're highly skewed, but it doesn't provide civil discourse. And ultimately, that has huge repercussions following the legislation.
As a Democrat, I hope Medicare is a major issue in the 2012 elections. It'll maybe distract people from the economy. I think Representative Ryan gave us an enormous gift, but I there's another reason, and there really is a very a sort of a personal problem of mine, but it is really striking to me how two incredibly smart, incredibly politically savvy policy wonks were elected as the last two most recent Democratic presidents and came to Washington without the slightest clue of what the Medicare program is, how it works, what its historical significance is for the Democratic Party or the various base groups in the Democratic Party, and what both its political assets and risks are. And it was really distressing to have to watch President Obama learn all over again exactly the same lessons that President Clinton learned in 93 and 94. Clinton finally caught on. I'm hopeful that Obama will eventually as well. But in fact, this is one of those issues where the bases of the two parties are fundamentally opposed to one another, and where even up to the most recent Kaiser polls, one of the few on which the majority of the American public is more sympathetic to the views of the Democratic base than the Republican base. And to have leading Democratic politicians not get that continues to really depress me.
Well, on that depressing note,
we're not all depressed about that difficulty in learning.
If you could please join me in thanking Bruce and Gail for coming. Thank you for coming. I think it was a great discussion, a lot of civil discourse, and I appreciate you all being here. Thanks so much.